My next stop on our clinical research review of the past year and ASCO is Dr. Dan Haller, editor of the Journal of Clinical Oncology. Dr. Haller began our conversation by providing a perspective on 2006 in terms of clinical research reports.
This was not a big colorectal year, Neil. It was a pancreas gastric year, so we can do a gig on that as well. But in colorectal cancer, it was a year of consolidation, I think, more or less. I think it was a year of people actually taking what we learned in ASCO from 2002 to 2004 and putting it into practice, learning about how to apply the results of the MOSAIC trial, how to actually give FOLFOX in the adjuvant setting. I heard or saw data, for example, with bevacizumab in advanced disease and found in the U.S. at least that there's about an 80% market penetration. Bottom line is I think the American oncologist is doing a wonderful job of selecting patients because my guess is based on the toxicity registry profile, the toxicity in the average patient in the community looks pretty much like trials, and that's a very important piece of data to have because sometimes trial patients are so extraordinarily selected that you worry whether you apply the drug to your patient, it's going to have the same toxicity profile you can quote from the Hurwitz trial, for example. What's important is that 20% probably represents the group that should not get the drug based on high risk of arteriothrombotic events, high risk of thrombosis, high risk of perforation, whatever, I think 80% might be the correct number.
Why don't we pick up on that? Because that certainly is a practical issue. It's now, really, it's only been 3 years since that Hurwitz presentation, hard to believe. And now the drug's being used extensively. There's an adjuvant Bev trial, CO8, that's almost closed. Three adjuvant Bev trials, but that one's almost closed. Where are we in terms of understanding toxicity? You mentioned the data from the community. Can you kind of sort of summarize where we are right now in terms of understanding the side effects and toxicity of bevacizumab?
I think as much as one can in a 3-year period of time. I think that the data from the Hurwitz trial, the toxicity profile is pretty much predictive of what one sees in practice. I have to say that I'm a little trepidatious about saying that because I use the drug fairly frequently with a large practice. It's been since February of 2004 that the drug has been available commercially, and I've not had a perforation, as there would in the room, since that time. I don't think I've missed them, but in fact, the perforation rate is in, you know, maybe 1 or 2%. And frankly, if you go back over my other population of patients who before bevacizumab, I may have had 1 or 2% of people perforate because of risk responses to chemotherapy or to the disease itself before that. So the registry trials have shown toxicity profiles, as reported ASCO this year, very similar to that seen in the Hurwitz trial. So I think that's comforting for me as a practitioner to go to a patient and say, this isn't just a highly selected patient population. This is what might happen to you. Having said that, if someone is at high risk, I might not treat them for the benefit that was seen. I tell them about perforation. In clinical trials in which we use bevacizumab, we have a card that goes in their wallet saying, I'm on this drug, and if I'm in an emergency room and I have a belly ache, take a flat plate. I might perforate because I can't assume that a doc that knows how to deal with a pneumothorax after a car accident knows about bevacizumab and perforation. So we don't overemphasize it, but I think raising patient awareness and responsibility for taking the drug is important, as we would, for example, giving drugs with febrile neutropenia. If you have a temperature, go to the ER. If you have a bellyache that doesn't go away, it could be a perf.
You mentioned higher risk situations such as?
That's the problem. For perforation, we don't know. For higher risk, for ATEs, we do know. We do know that people, ironically, the group who are aspirin takers, who probably are at higher risk, have a lower risk of ATEs, maybe because they're taking aspirin. That's a pretty big stretch, but it's theoretically quite reasonable.
ATEs on Bev?
On Bev. If you look at the post-hoc analysis of patients who are aspirin takers, and if they're aspirin takers, it's probably because there's a pretest probability that they have vascular disease or worry about it, they actually have a lower rate of an ATE, an arteriothrombotic event. So a practical answer is, what do? Control hypertension very carefully. If there are no contraindications, a baby aspirin. That's not bad for most of us. It's probably good for preventing colon cancer, but it's also good for vascular disease. And as my mother would say, it can't hurt.
And in the metastatic setting, of course, you have to balance the threat of the tumor. You know, how do you sort of kind of come up with an estimate based on prior events, how long the events were, what type of events, and sort of putting together a decision?
In terms of the predisposition to ATEs?
Right.
you're right. You have to have that long-term discussion about the problems related to the tumor versus the potential problems related to the drug. So that if I have a patient, and I think we do tend to fall into the theory that all patients are created equal, and they're not. So take two patients. One is a 78-year-old person with three pulmonary nodules not considered curable by surgical resection with a prior history of an MI 5 years ago. The other is a 40-year-old patient with bulky disease causing pain and leading to a decreased performance status, yet with serosal implants. Well, in one, I'd be comfortable in saying, I'm not even sure, first, that I even need to treat this patient right now. We just happen to have found, by lead time bias, three pulmonary nodules that are asymptomatic. Do I really need to throw everything at that patient? Or, as in breast cancer, is it true, perhaps, that sequential single-agent therapies might be just as good as everything up front? Conversely, in the patient who is sick from their tumor, doing sequential therapies may not be a real smart thing to do. If you wait until they become ecteric because their liver is too big, you might lose the opportunity to use one of the three chemotherapeutic drugs, irinotecan. As you know, two of the ASCO abstracts this year, I think, were on a regimen sometimes called FOLFIRINOX, which is all three drugs. And unsurprisingly, the response rate was quite high with that. So was toxicity. But if you had a patient with bulky disease and impending obstruction of an organ, it might be reasonable to consider that FOLFIRINOX plus both biologics, which could be the endpoint of one of the arms of the current intergroup trial to some degree, of FOLFOX or FOLFIRI plus either cetuximab or bevacizumab or both, based on the toxicity and efficacy data from the BOND-2 trial for both cetuximab and bevacizumab, you might consider all of those. I gave one patient FOLFOX, as it turned out, plus bevacizumab plus cetuximab recently because they presented in a young individual with both a intact primary, big-time omental and intraperitoneal disease and ascites, and was in pain, requiring fentanyl. And I treated the patient, and 2 weeks later, with FOLFOX plus bevacizumab plus cetuximab, because they weren't eligible for the trial, it wasn't active yet in our institution indeed, but based on data and based on intuition, because I thought response was important, that median survivorship was not an issue for this patient, it was response. And about a week into the treatment, the patient's mother called me and said, you know, I don't know what you're doing to my son, but he's lost 12 pounds this week. And I said, well, can I talk to him? And she said, no, he's out on his motorcycle. And the actuality was he lost 12 pounds because he diuresed all his ascites. And he had an unbelievable response. And frankly, it was the first time, Neil, that I was worried that I might have caused tumor lysis in a colon cancer patient because he had such a rapid response. And sometimes this even leads to misleading sorts of pieces of information like rising CEAs, rising LDHs a week or two into biochemotherapy because the tumor is so responsive as opposed to unresponsive that those levels actually go up before they go down again.
I'm trying to think whether I should do some type of warning like they do when they, you know, the test drivers. This is an experienced test driver. Do not try this
at
home.
Yes.
Or not FDA approved or whatever.
Well, I think it speaks to the heterogeneity of our patient population that saying that FOLFIRI plus bevacizumab is the first-line therapy for every patient, it can't be true. It must be true that there are some patients in whom sequential therapies are going to be just as good as multiple combinations up front. And if one only uses medians, you're going to dummy down the data and go counterintuitive to what the average clinician and patient understands about their disease.
Getting back to the issue of the ATEs and, you know, when you pull the trigger with metastatic disease, you're a 78-year-old man with a prior MI. Assuming he were sicker or you needed a response more quickly, would you consider adding bevacizumab in a patient like that?
I absolutely would. I think that every therapy we give has a certain inherent toxicity. And just because this is a unique toxicity we've not dealt with before, older people are more likely to have febrile neutropenia. They have less good bone marrows. So I think, again, I'm a believer in aspirin for a lot of different reasons. So I do think, yes, I would control hypertension. I would have the patient followed by their cardiologist with me if they had a cardiac disease. I'd think about aspirin as something one could administer. One is never going to do a trial of aspirin, yes or no, in a prospective sense. So you have to do the best with the data you have. And then you have to explain to the patient that you might have a slightly increased risk of this event, and we can't predict it, but these are the things we're going to do to try to reduce your risk. But the end point is better control of your tumor, and it's important because. And if you can't explain why, that is, we're going to reduce your pain, increase your personal survival by X or Y, The other is that, for example, with hypertension, at least that one sort of creeps up on you. It's not an acute event. I think perforation and a TIA are unpredictable events. But again, these are patients with cancer. They have those events as a baseline.
Is there a formula that you can look at to try to predict the chance of AT? I mean, for example, let's say this man had his MI 6 months ago. Is there age? Is there a way to come up with a more tangible number?
There really is not. I mean, there are the data. And I think the data from the, it's called the BEAT trial by Roche, BEAT in Europe, which is really a registry trial, and the BRIGHT registry trial in the US will at least give us numbers and proportionality. But I don't think that it's going to happen that one is going to be able to plug in those data into a Gale model, for example, or a predictive model as for adjuvant therapy of colon cancer and say your baseline risk of a pulmonary embolism or a clot in your left median carotid artery is blank and with bevacizumab it's 1.8 blank. I just think one needs to know it's not 10 times or, you know, a hazard ratio of 0.89 or 0.92. I think one just needs to be a clinician.
You mentioned the hypertension. Any data to suggest that maybe it might be like the rash and EGFR inhibitors that might predict response?
There is an association with better outcome in people who become hypertensive, and that was seen in some other anti-VEGF agents other than bevacizumab and other diseases. What that means is unclear to me. As I said, I frequently rely on Lee Ellis at MD Anderson to sort of explain clinician to clinician what the associations could be. It could very well be that the same things that cause hypertension are the same that cause increased tumor permeability and therefore increased drug delivery, so that the vascular, it's not a specific anti-tumor effect as it is a mark of a better drug delivery system, if you will. So that could be one correlation. Whether one needs to push the drug to hypertension or as one is doing in some studies with cetuximab of pushing to rash or erlotinib of pushing to rash is unclear. Is it native to the host that rashers and hypertensives are better than not? Or is it increasing the drug to that point important? I don't know.
These agents are being tested and will continue to be tested in the adjuvant setting. How do you think the rash is going to play out as adjuvant therapy?
That's a good question. There is a trial, a large trial, and the intergroup trial, N0147, which was much more complicated before the irinotecan regimens became less attractive, which is FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab for 6 months. And the question you raise is not necessarily one of efficacy, but compliance and tolerability. In my heart, I believe that as a single agent, cetuximab has activity. It's synergistic with both 5-FU and oxaliplatin in animal models. We'll see from the cetuximab and panitumumab trials how much it adds in first-line therapy. We've learned that first-line metastatic advanced disease treatment doesn't always predict the adjuvant model, as example for FOLFIRI in the PTAC-3 study. The question is, in advanced disease, when these drugs are tested in third- and fourth-line treatment and you have no other options, a rash is the least thing you're going to think about, frankly, because you don't have many other options to survive or respond or have response of your symptoms. In the adjuvant setting, if you have someone with an 80% cure rate with surgery alone, and you add 5% with 5-FU, another 3% with oxaliplatin, there's only so much cetuximab can add. It's probably 1 or 2 or 3%. So are 97 people going to walk around with a rash for 6 months? We've used the drug quite extensively, frankly, and you know the rash is something you can deal with, but it is visible. And for patients in the adjuvant setting to go to work with FOLFOX, where they're not losing their hair and they're not necessarily open, if you will, and out to the world, they're going to have to explain away something that's really quite visible. And that's a difficult thing to do, I think, for some patients. Not everybody wants to wear banners about what their disease is or what their prognosis is and discuss it.
Flipping back to the issue of, you know, recent research data, anything come out at ASCO that you think was practice-changing or important to discuss?
In colorectal cancer, as I said, I think it was a year of adjustments and baby steps. The big steps backward and forward were in gastric and pancreas. I think in colorectal cancer, probably the more interesting data had to do with important details about rectal cancer therapy, about using response to treatment as a prognosticator. In colon cancer, it really was a year of not much happening, I'm afraid. But that's okay. We needed a rest. We needed to digest what happened the last 2 years.
Can you talk a little bit about the rectal data?
Yeah, I think that we had been stuck for many, many years in a U.S. model of surgery followed by chemoradiation, and in Europe's radiation followed by surgery. End of discussion. With the Europeans in large part going from north to south, not believing that there was any role for chemotherapy because it hadn't been proven, which seems to me a little bit rigid. I'm not sure that a rectal cancer cell knows that it came from the rectum as opposed to the colon when it comes to chemosensitivity. We've always entered relapsed patients with both colon and rectal into the same trials, and there's never been a difference in chemosensitivity. So I do think there is room for people to extrapolate the data from the colon cancer world into the rectal cancer world without doing a defined trial to re-answer decades-old questions. So if there are trials that are not positive in Europe with chemo radiation versus chemotherapy alone, it's because they were not powered enough to look for reasonable endpoints. So I think the evolution has been toward chemo radiotherapy plus surgery, and then the question was, in what order? I think the German trial, which has been presented and published, is an important one. It tells us that in the long run, in terms of survival, which is typically the only endpoint people sometimes look at, they're about the same. That is, three treatments given in a proper sequence are equivalent. But there are other issues in rectal cancer, including quality of life, local control, sphincter preservation. The German trial showed basically half the risk of local relapse, 6 versus 12%. So I think that the message there is that if one looks at institutional data, anybody's institution, 5 years from now, if you're seeing a local failure rate of more than 5%, you're doing something wrong, or you're really getting a bad population of patients. The other is that preoperative treatment is less toxic on the whole. Both acute and late, if one includes only four-year follow-up, toxicities are less. Using downstaging is important. That is, the pathologic downstaging is important, not only from that trial, but from a number of trials, including NSABP-R03, which was terminated early because of slow accrual, looking at the same question of pre-op versus post-op, and other trials, including the German study. There are two things that downstaging 3 allows for. One is the potential for increased sphincter preservation. In the German trial, colostomy rates were halved, and one hopes that is not ever going to be associated with loss of local control. That is, that with the knowledge that someone's gotten chemo radiation therapy, that a surgeon takes unnecessary risk of performing sphincter preservation. It didn't pan out in the German study, but again, four-year data. Let's see 5 and 10-year data, and also no compromise of sphincter function. The other is, in terms of downstaging, the use of downstaging in clinical trials is very important, because if we now do a rectal cancer study and say we're only going to decide on our next study when we have 5-year survival data, we'll be doing one study every 10 years. If we use, as in colon cancer, 3-year DFS or disease-free survivorship as a surrogate for long-term outcome, if it's true that downstaging a patient to an N0, T0 state is predictive of a better treatment in the long run, well, that would be wonderful for patients in clinical trials. Wonderful for a patient, because you can say, look, in studies, when people have been downstaged, they had a very good long-term outcome. And I think that's a fair statement to make to patients. It's not cheerleading and grandstanding. It's fact. The other is that one can begin to design your next trial based on the data collected at the time of surgery, as opposed to based on data collected 2, 3, and 4 years later in terms of relapse and death. And with newer treatments for metastatic disease, death is fortunately very delayed, so that if someone relapses at a median of 3.2 years and lives 4 years after that, you're talking about 7 or 8 years of follow-up at the very least before you can even hope to see a survival difference. And that's not the only reason we treat people, is to make the median person live longer. It's to make all people do better, not only in terms of their length of life, but their quality of life.
The NSABP rectal study R04, which originally started out comparing capecitabine to continuous infusion 5-FU with radiation therapy, has now been amended to include oxaliplatin. Can you talk about what we know about neoadjuvant oxaliplatin, including the data you presented at ASCO?
Yes, I think that certainly this is based on laboratory inference, which is that platinates are all synergistic with radiation therapy. It's the reason that platinums and fluoropyrimidines have been used in head and neck cancer, lung cancer, cervical cancer, you name the disease. There is a good preclinical rationale for including platinates with radiation, expecting not only synergism, not only additive therapy, but also synergy. So that's the preclinical rationale. The clinical rationale is that there were two U.S. trials, an CLGB and an ECOG trial, which incorporated infusional 5-FU and either biweekly or weekly oxaliplatin, showing pathologic complete response rates in the mid-20 range. This compares to about a 10% range seen in the German study with preoperative 5-FU and radiation, and in historical series of preoperative treatment with radiation and 5-FU or radiation alone. So, of course, that's not a randomized comparison, and there might be patient selection involved in this. But then there are a whole series of other phase 1-2 trials. I frankly have now stopped counting. I have so many slides of them from the U.S. and abroad looking at this that one sees reliably pathologic complete response rates from the mid-teens at the low end to about 38 or 40%. To me, the consistency of the data is important. At our own institution, because we had done the ECOG trial, when we finished accruing patients to the study, the data were so intriguing, especially to our radiation oncologists and surgeons who actually look at these patients and see what their tumors look like, that they were hesitant to want to refer a patient unless they thought they might get oxaliplatin as part of a, quote, standard, unquote, regimen. Well, I think certainly we had enough toxicity data to explain to a patient what they were receiving. They had colorectal cancer, so using the drug seemed reasonable. And so we collected a rather large series of patients over 5 years who were not on study, who did get infusional 5-FU, and we gradually migrated toward the weekly regimen of 50 to 60 milligrams per meter squared because it's rationally, I think, a bit more logical to use weekly rather than biweekly treatment with radiation therapy to get more exposure of the drug and radiation together. And what we saw was a path CR rate, and you know, that was equivalent to that seen in the study. So this was in typically chosen patients, not a highly selected population, those who would ordinarily have received radiation and 5-FU. The NSABP trial is important because I think it is a randomized comparison, and hopefully it will put to rest the two issues. One is the oxaliplatin phase 1-2 data real? I think it will be. And the other is, certainly in terms of path CR rate, I have no question about that. The other is, can one routinely, and I think routine is the operative word here, routinely substitute an oral fluoropyrimidine for IV? Certainly there are a lot of data from phase 1-2 studies to suggest that one can do it. We know the dose, we know the schedule, we know its tolerability. In a curative situation, I think you want more than that. You want not only the ability to do it, but the sense that you're not giving an inferior regimen. With accumulating data from the EXACT trial, for example, in colon cancer, I think that one gets more belief that you can substitute the oral fluoropyrimidine for IV 5-FU. But I'm more prone to believing that in metastatic disease and in the adjuvant colon setting where the data are existent, as opposed to just believing it in a patient with rectal cancer, for example, who is off study, who is going for cure and also going for quality of life and going for the sphincter preservation.
Another aspect of quality of life is oral versus a pump. What are your observations on that?
You know, when oxaliplatin first came on the market and people were concerned that American docs couldn't use a pump, I was worried about that statement. I mean, here are people that do bone marrow transplants. What's the big deal about a port and a pump? It wasn't a big deal. It just was a matter of learning a new technique. I think there are two aspects is infusional therapy is much more tolerable than bolus therapy. We know that from every study that's been done. We know it in rectal cancer, in fact, from the Intergroup 0144 study. So that things like febrile neutropenia and mucositis and diarrhea, if you look at just the infusional therapy alone, is almost non-existent. So it's a very efficient way and efficacious way of giving fluoropyrimidine therapy. For the majority of my patients, having a port and a pump is not a huge issue. Once they get to do it, it's one factor of their life they learn to deal with. And because of its tolerability, I guess only I can tell them how bad it could be if they were taking the Mayo regimen. So they have nothing to compare to. But they don't really have a lot of toxicity with that moiety of their treatment alone.
Yeah, but we're comparing this to capecitabine.
Correct. So if you then say, well, if capecitabine were equally efficacious, for some patients, they like coming to my office. For some of my patients on oral therapies or even on no treatment at all, they like coming because it's part of their treatment to see me and the nurse who works with me and to get monitored. They feel good being monitored. Being away from us is not necessarily a positive. For some patients, pill taking is not always the best thing in the world. They may have 12 other pills that they're taking and taking 5 in the morning and 5 in the evening for 2 weeks on and 2 weeks off, or a week on and a week off, rather. may be difficult. But for many patients, if it's an option, then I can lay it out to them and say, here are the two options. Here are the pros and the cons. Of my adjuvant patients in whom I now give single agent fluoropyrimidine, I would say it's about 50-50 right now. And these are frequently older stage 3 patients who have low risk of recurrence and some stage 2 patients. My default is not infusional therapy, but Roswell Park regimen. And then there's capecitabine. And I use the standard dose regimen used in the EXACT trial, but I'm very quick to dose reduce and dose modify, which was done in the EXACT trial. The majority of patients had dose modifications and delays.
Speaking of dose, you presented some data at ASCO on dose of capecitabine that was fascinating and I think long awaited. Can you summarize that?
Yeah, all of us as American oncologists were impressed with the fact that somehow we thought we were doing something wrong. What was it about our patients that made them look so much more toxic than that described in trials? Was this a unique trial situation? Or did Europeans have some innate ability to do this, like write music and make really good food? We didn't know what was the cause. And so based on the study that I was the chair of, which compared Zelox versus either the Roswell or the Mayo Clinic regimen in 1,800 patients in stage 3 colon cancer, I asked the sponsor to go back to the data and see what were the toxicity differences. And Hans Schmall, who was the co-chair of the study with me, and I looked at the data, about 80% of the patients came from the ROW, as we call it, and 20% from the U.S. And the U.S. population, just on the surface of it, clearly had more toxicity.
ROW being rest of the world.
Rest of the world. Everybody but us, as defined by George. And so the bottom line is that we took the data and we combined it with data from the two trials in advanced disease of Mayo versus capecitabine and looked at the toxicity profile, very consistent across the board. We also then looked historically, and if you look at the IMPACT data, which was a compilation of five of leucovorin regimens versus surgery alone in colon cancer, Europeans had less toxicity with any 5-FU and leucovorin regimen. So when we put the data all together, we presented it as an updated ASCO this year, and Hans did the toxicity data for the Zeloxa study, and I did the poster presentation on capecitabine in these different settings, both metastatic and the adjuvant setting, with or without oxaliplatin. And it was clear that the hazard ratios were about 1.8, as I recall, for almost any toxicity you could name, including myelosuppression, which is non-self-reported, as well as some self-reported toxicities like diarrhea and mucositis. So that it's no longer unclear that Americans do have more toxicity. This is a truth. I don't think it has to do with docs not following protocols. These are patients on studies. So it's not just that they have practices where you weren't monitoring patients properly. One theoretical possibility, and there's a nice presentation on the ASCO website by Neil Maripol about this, is that it may be a combination of both pharmacogenetic factors, that is, Americans, as a mongrel race, if you will, have maybe a profile of high toxicity patients. The other, which is more likely because we are a mix of cultures, is that it has to do with some sort of external environmental factor like diet. And it's very clear that American diets are very high in folates. People who know these things, like Carmen Allegra and others who do the biochemistry of fluoropyrimidines, would suggest that it might be due to the high folate supplements in our diet, as well as the not only unknown, like in foods, but also known, taken to reduce cardiovascular disease or in multivitamins, that may be contributing to an effect such as leucovorin adds to 5-FU that increases its toxicity, cytotoxicity. We're actually analyzing some of the data from the Zeloxa trial, some of the samples from the Zeloxa trial, to look for homocysteine levels, which is the invert folate. So we want to see whether there's a correlation. On a practical level, if I'm giving someone capecitabine, I not only take a prescription medication history, but I say, what else are you taking? Don't be embarrassed. You know, we know that at least 40% of American patients take some form of, quote, complementary therapy. That could be almost anything, including multivitamins, but many of the things do include folates. And I ask them to lay off the folates, at least initially, until we get a sense of their toxicity profile with the drug, because I don't want to sacrifice efficacy for the theoretical likelihood that folates might reduce their risk of polyps in the future or cardiovascular disease.
What's Zeloxa, incidentally?
Zeloxa is the acronym for the Zelox adjuvant trial.
Oh, so Zelox.
Correct. Okay, so it's Zelox versus either Roswell or Mayo.
Getting back to the issue of rectal cancer, so it sounds like you're using oxaliplatin neoadjuvantly off-study fairly frequently.
We do, and we offer it, as I think we do any emerging technology. When I first started at Penn in 1980, we had and still do have one of the largest experience of lumpectomy and radiation for breast cancer. In fact, people would come by train from New York, because at the same time that the New York institutions were doing radical mastectomies in 1980, we were offering lumpectomy and radiation based on non-randomized data suggesting benefit. This is way ahead of the NSABP studies showing equivalency in terms of outcome. So at that time, we told people, this is the standard of care, 5-FU and radiation. However, there are emerging data suggesting strongly that oxaliplatin is not only tolerable, but certainly increases downstaging. Whether it increases survival, we don't know yet. And if one looks at the data, for example, with toxicity, since neurotoxicity is the chief concern, if one is getting 60 milligrams per meter squared times 5, 300 milligrams per meter squared, it's a pretty low dose of oxaliplatin. One typically doesn't start seeing significant neurotoxicity till double that amount. So if one is only giving that amount of oxaliplatin, I think that the concern about the chief side effect of that drug is mostly allayed.
So what do you do postoperatively, particularly in the patient who's had a complete response?
Yes. I use the preoperative staging to predict what I'm going to choose in the postoperative setting. So if someone, based on, I think, our very good MRI techniques and very good EUS techniques, is a T3N0 patient without a lot of bad prognostic features, and they get any form of preoperative therapy independent of their response by pathology, I will offer an additional 4 months of at least fluoropyrimidine therapy. That gives them 6 months. And if they have a port in, for example, I'll just do 8 cycles or 4 months of LV5-FU2. That was shown in the Andre study to be equivalent to the Mayo Clinic regimen. The current intergroup trial assigns all patients to FOLFOX plus or minus bevacizumab. And I think that's a reasonable option, certainly. Again, extrapolating. The original question was asking, is FOLFOX better than 5-FU leucovorin? And there was also a FOLFIRI question. But I think we decided we didn't want to go down that path of separating colon and rectum quite that much and redo the MOSAIC trial, redo the FLOX trial in rectal cancer, so that if someone, for example, has had no neurotoxicity and they got oxaliplatin preoperatively and they started out with positive nodes and a T3 lesion, I would probably offer them FOLFOX and do it for 8 cycles. And that would give them roughly about 850 milligrams per meter squared, maybe 900, which was equivalent to that given in the FLOX, in the NSABP FLOX study, and close to the delivered dose and the projected dose for the MOSAIC trial.
Anything you want to add to anything you said today?
I think emphasizing what a good job docs do in our practices at making decisions about patients. The more I do your talks, the more I meet docs from around the country, because they do what I do but have to do it in the context of many other diseases. Their decision-making seems to be extraordinarily good given the inundation of data, given the fact that in 3 years we've had not three new drugs necessarily, but three more ways of treating patients introduced, including more oral therapies, the introduction of oxaliplatin into both advanced and adjuvant setting, bevacizumab, cetuximab. That's a huge sea change for people to incorporate into practice. And being able to stay ahead of their patients and stay comparable to the best institutions in the country in terms of expertise is really a credit, I think, not only to them, but also to programs like yours that tries to focus on what are the real changes that have occurred and how do people think this is playing out in the community. And I think it's a remarkable testimony to the ability of people in very busy lives to incorporate these changes so rapidly and I think very responsibly.